Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Death of Death, where we proclaim Christ's victory over sin, death, and everything else. I'm your host, Nick Stewart, and today we have another edition of Restaurant of the Mind, where I cover all the books I've been reading. One of the most beautiful things in life is sharing things you like with other people, so I look forward to these episodes. And there's really no business to get to today, so we can just jump right in. Continuing my trek through Michael Crichton's books, I read Prey, and this is a book about nanobots, and boy did it make me itchy. If you have any problem with, like, infestations and things like that, this book could mess you up pretty badly. So, the nanobots in this book are 1/100th the size of a human hair, and each one is a tiny camera, so together, millions and millions of them form one high-resolution camera. It starts out as a new medical product meant to be injected into someone so they can look anywhere in your body internally. But as most experiments in Crichton stories go, it goes awry. A swarm breaks loose in the desert and evolves differently than the other nanobots because it's entirely unfettered from human control. And these have artificial intelligence, so they solve problems and evolve generations and generations over the course of an hour. It's just a black cloud of tiny little mechanisms, and they're capable of a lot of destruction. So it includes a surprisingly compelling story between the main character, Jack, and his wife, Julia. Jack has recently become a stay-at-home dad after losing his job, and Julia continues to work at the same company, so a resentment soon builds between them, and then he suspects her of cheating. I was surprised by how interested I became in this story, even though I was anxiously awaiting the advent of those nanobots. I don't want to spoil anything else from this 18-year-old book if you haven't read it, so I'll leave it at that, but it was probably my favorite Crichton novel so far. It had the best balance of compelling characters, science, and good story. So those are things most present in his later books. And I think this is the third last book he wrote before he died. So it's pretty late in the game, if you don't count the posthumous books. So if concepts like artificial intelligence interest you, then this is a good one. There's also a bibliography in the back with lots of books and articles on artificial intelligence and things like that, if it compels you to read further on that topic. Next up, we've got The Son of God and the New Creation by Graham Goldsworthy. This is another volume in the Short Studies in Biblical Theology series. It's so good that I can't really commend it to you enough. This one goes through the biblical account of the Messiah as the Son of God, and Jesus being declared the Son of God by the resurrection, and then the implications for us as the sons of God. It was very good. It was a topic I probably wouldn't have chosen to read about if it wasn't part of this series, which is another good thing about these books. If you commit to reading the whole series, then you'll probably read about things you otherwise probably wouldn't have. So it starts with Adam being the firstborn of God, all these characters coming in and out of the biblical narrative, looking as though they could be the new Adam, the one who will keep the covenant where Adam failed, but then they themselves fail and we're left waiting for another new Adam. In the same way, it's similar with the title Son of God. So it starts with Adam, then later God refers to Israel as his firstborn. He's obviously not committing an anachronism by saying this. Firstborn doesn't refer to chronology, but it's an entitlement given by God. So later, Jesus will come to be the firstborn of God and apply that title to us as well. So we are considered partakers in that sonship. It's a very good book in a good series, and it has very cool artwork on the covers as well. So can't commend it enough. Next up, we got Gentle and Lowly by Dane Ortlund. I got this book because I heard Dane Ortlund on Doctrine and Devotion. Let me back up and explain my thought process here. It's taken me a long time to realize and come to value the way that other people think. So I think of myself as a very, like, mind-oriented guy. You know, I've been known not to take seriously people who are more heart-oriented or gut-oriented. And finally, someone was able to explain to me that the heart and the gut are just different ways of thinking. So I'm someone who thinks with my head, and that means I'm not as likely to make decisions based on my feelings or my instinct. So since realizing this and coming to view these as legitimate ways of thinking, I've been desiring to get a handle on how my heart works and try to be more in touch with the old ticker. So when I hear about a book or a sermon that will quote-unquote really affect my heart, it becomes very interesting to me. In the interview that I heard with Dane Ortlund, the way he talked about this topic just sounded like a manhole with no cover that you could just fall into and never climb out of, and I mean that in a good way. The only place in all of Scripture where Jesus reveals his heart to us is in Matthew 11, when he says, "I am gentle and lowly of heart." Ortlund spends the book exploring the many facets and implications of this for us as sinners and sufferers. So we often want to fix ourselves before we go to God. We want to get over our sin before we come into his presence. And the heart of Christ is most sympathetic to us in our times of sin and suffering than we are to ourselves. I learned many things from this book, but one thing I had to really relax on is my militant devotion to impassibility. So I don't mean that I stopped believing in impassibility. I mean I just have to let the Bible speak for itself. So when the Bible says that God is grieved in his heart, for example, my nature, my natural inclination is to start arguing for why it doesn't mean what it sounds like, and that's fine and good, but sometimes I completely lose what it is trying to say. So all this talk of Jesus' heart, God's heart, Jesus' suffering really had my impassibility feelers up in the air, but I had to relax and let it speak to me what it means to speak to me. The Bible is definitely trying to convey something when it says those things, so instead of dwelling on what it's not saying, I need to dwell on what it is saying, and I found by doing that I benefited greatly from what the Bible has to tell us about the heart of Christ. So he also utilizes the Puritans a lot, and it made me really want to get into some Puritan stuff. It's been a long time since I've set out on the difficult but immensely enjoyable task of reading some Puritan works. So in summation, this book will be a very good book for your heart, and I highly recommend it. Next up, we got Writing Tools, 55 Essential Strategies for Every Writer by Roy Peter Clark. This is a book that Patreon supporter and occasional guest of the show, Trevor Wright, bought me a few years back, and I just finally finished it. It is exactly what it claims to be in the title. It's 55 chapters on being a better writer. So it starts out with really practical things like not using adverbs unless they change the verb and not using a lot of words that end in ing. Then it graduates into more complex things. He straddles the line of what's useful for fiction and what's useful for nonfiction, but almost all these tools are applicable to both. So one important one is the concept of the story engine, like what drives the story forward. In the case of this podcast, what's driving it forward is I want to tell you about some books I've been reading, and you want to get those recommendations. So everything I say in this podcast should be moving along to that end. He says repeatedly to get the name of the dog, which means to get every detail you can about the thing you're writing about. Doesn't have to make it into the finished product, but sometimes those tiny details really bring things to life, so this is the most practical book I've ever read on writing. So if you're a writer or if you want to get into writing, this is definitely a good place to start. Next up, we've got Anatomy of the State by Murray Rothbard. If I could wager what his motive was in writing this, I'd say he attempted to give a purely observational work on the concept of government. So he speaks in the abstract with only the occasional venture into things specific to American politics. He starts with the fact that the state is really just a concept. So the only difference between you and the state is that you don't have a monopoly on force, and the state does. The state has no inherent right or privilege. It only has what it takes, and it only has what we ascribe to it. So we've just decided that certain people are in charge of punishment and in charge of taxes and in charge of roads and all these things. And that's really the only power that they have, is just that we've all kind of collectively decided that this is the entity that handles these things. This book is only about 55 pages, so it's amazing the amount of things that he crammed into this short work. It's probably really not even considered a book. It's more of a pamphlet. And he moves on from the concept of the state to their control over the educational system. There's a reason why most academics are statists. The state funds education at a more rapid rate than private institutions, and the reason for that is that it's the only way for the state to continue, really. If people thought critically about it, it wouldn't be long before we didn't have it anymore. So the state funds education and forces everyone to go to a state-approved school so they can teach the necessity of the state, and nobody grows up to question its existence, for the most part. This book was written in 1974, so it is downright eerie how his observations of how the state creates enemies was so spot on when it comes to 9/11 and our affairs in the Middle East. He observes that the state will make you so afraid of your enemy that you'll let them do whatever they want to keep you safe. So cue the Patriot Act. They'll make you feel like the enemy is attacking you specifically and not your government. And indeed, we did see this happen in the events of 9/11, but no one raises the question of why this happened. 9/11 didn't figuratively fall out of the sky, although I guess it did literally, but not figuratively. There was a lot of U.S. government malfeasance leading up to us getting attacked that way, so we don't tend to focus on that so much. They just sort of painted it like this attack came out of nowhere and we were targeted specifically and not the government. But in reality, it was the government's actions that led to it. So that was kind of a rabbit trail. I just wanted to underline how creepy it was that in 1974, it sounded like he was writing about the Iraq War after the fact. This is a short thing, so it makes some of the more complex parts a little easier to handle. I highly recommend it as a starting point in libertarianism or anarcho-capitalism, if you're into that kind of thing. All right, so next up is The Andromeda Strain by Michael Crichton, another Crichton book here. This is an older one. Most of the other ones I've been reading are from like the late 80s to the early 2000s, but this one was published in 1969. So a satellite is sent into space to collect things for a study, just dust and organisms and things like that, mostly the only stuff you can find in space. It comes back into orbit and lands in a small town in Arizona, and everybody dies. So some biologists, maybe epidemiologists, go investigate and find an old man and a baby have survived it. So they have to figure out what these two people have in common, like why they were able to survive this biochemical thing, and also figure out what this virus is. So one of the things that's good about Crichton is that in every book, he just submerges you into the world of a particular study. So if you're reading one of the Jurassic Park books, you're submerged into the world of paleontology and evolution and things like that. If you're reading Prey, which I talked about earlier, you're just submerged into the world of artificial intelligence and all the implications of that. In Next, you're submerged into the world of genetics. In this book, you're submerged into the world of microbiology and virology. I'll be honest, there were some things that I didn't understand, but even when I didn't understand the specifics, he packages the information in such a way that I at least understand how it impacts the story, and it's still interesting. So even if you don't know the ins and outs of microbiology, you still understand the point being made and what it means for the characters and the story. So still a very enjoyable read if you're ignorant to those things like I am. I won't belabor any more praise of Michael Crichton for now, because there are a few more of his books left to talk about. I think maybe just one more. So next up is The Gospel, How the Church Portrays the Beauty of Christ by Ray Ortlund. This is written by Ray Ortlund, like I said, father of the aforementioned Dane Ortlund. This is a very small book, and after discussing it with a group of about 8 or 9 other men, I realized that there are a lot of different angles from which you could classify this work, but I would say it's basically about how to be a gospel-centered church. And that is a very blown-out phrase that hardly means anything anymore, but I think this book serves well to tie up all those unknown ends that go along with the phrase and get that phrase back to actually meaning something again. I wish I had written a few things down as I was reading it, and unfortunately I left this book in California along with most of my library, but one thing I recall is him explaining gospel doctrine and gospel culture, and he basically said if you have the doctrine without the culture, you'll be hypocritical, and if you have the culture without the doctrine, you'll be incredibly fragile. So only with both gospel culture and gospel doctrine do you have the power of the Spirit behind you, and that will make for a healthy church. So far, I like everything I've read by any member of the Ortlund family. Ray and I think 2, maybe even 3 of his sons all write theology, and they've all been very good so far. Next up is Covenant and God's Purpose for the World by Thomas Schreiner. This is another in the Short Studies in Biblical Theology series. It's very similar to all of the introductory works that I've ever read on covenant theology, but it's about half the length. So if you're trying to introduce these ideas to someone or looking for introductory materials for yourself even, this might be a very good place to start with them. I find that every work on this topic can unveil a lot to me about Scripture that I didn't know before. And since I've read a lot on covenant theology, this was a lot of really useful repetition, inculcation, if you will. But one thing in particular I can remember that I learned from this book specifically is the flow of the first 6 chapters of Genesis. So you have the garden narrative, and then Cain and Abel, that's chapter 4. And then chapter 6 is Noah. So what's the deal with chapter 5? Is that just a random genealogy? No, and I've never noticed this before, but Schreiner calls it a roll call of death. So death and sin enter the picture in chapter 3. We see the effects of it taking place in chapter 4 with Cain and Abel. And then in chapter 5, we get a long list of people and how they died. Like the reign of death is continuing. And then that leads us into the flood narrative in chapter 6. So I feel like I'll spend the rest of my life uncovering little details like that about the Bible, and we'll never know it all. And that's as comforting as it is horrifying. So another good book in this very good series, and a great primer on covenant theology. So next up is, yes, another Crichton book. This is Sphere by Michael Crichton. This one is about a team of professionals in different academic fields sent to investigate what they believe to be an alien spaceship on the floor of the ocean. So the main character is a psychologist. So remember how I told you that each Crichton book submerges you into a world? Well, this book literally submerges you because it mostly takes place on a submarine, but it also submerges you into the world of psychology. So this character has to figure out the psychology, or the assumed psychology, of a life form that he doesn't know anything about yet. How do we know they could even communicate with us? What if they have a sense that we don't? What if they don't see or hear, but they have this other sense entirely, and we have literally no way to relate to them? Like, how would we let them know that we mean them no harm? So toward the end of the book, and this isn't going to spoil anything, but the example is given about an organism in space coming across a satellite, and they get on the satellite and they're exploring it, and it ends up getting into the wiring of the satellite, and it's just fried to death. Now the organism, this tiny little organism, will probably think that this was a huge trap set for microorganisms to fall into. But that's because the organism doesn't have even like any categories to understand what that satellite could possibly be used for. So eventually, the psychological framework is applied to the unconscious, and I can't really say any more without giving massive spoilers, so I'll leave it at that. But this was written in 89, so it's right in between Crichton's early stuff with less developed story and characters, and his later stuff that has much better story and characters. So far, by my estimation, this is like the turning point at which his characters started to get a lot more interesting and compelling. So 89, and then, you know, the 90s lead us into like Jurassic Park, and I think Timeline was in the 90s, and then the 2000s have like Prey and State of Fear and Next. I'm reading State of Fear now, so on the next Restaurant of the Mind, you'll definitely get to hear about that one and all of its climate change wonderful information. Well, unfortunately, given how busy I've been with the recent move, that's all I've been able to finish reading since our last Restaurant of the Mind episode, so we'll have to leave it there, but I think our next one is going to be in January, first Tuesday of January. I want to know what you're reading, so head over to Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter, and comment what you've been reading on the recent graphic, which will ask the question, what have you been reading? Also, if you're not a Patreon subscriber, it's only $4 a month, and like I say, that's less than a good cup of coffee. So that gives you early access to this podcast, an entirely separate, exclusive podcast, occasional voting rights for episode topics, and some hopefully soon-to-be-announced deals on merchandise. So you'll want to head over to patreon.com/deathofdeath to get started over there. I've been your host, Nick, here to warn you that the nanobots have achieved symbiosis. And if you're as committed to Christ's victory as I am, I'll be here to do it with you all again next week. Goodbye for now.